This episode is brought to you by Rad Dudes Who Love Nature.
Well, is it going to hurt my, my golden retriever? I'm like, you're an 80-pound golden retriever?
Welcome back to another episode of the Urban Wildlife Podcast. It's been a while, but we're still ticking. So this is Billy Brown, one of your co-hosts, and we've also got
Tony Crosdale
coming to us from a secure location in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania.
Yes, indeed. I am quarantined.
The pandemic is not over, folks.
The pandemic's not over if you have children in preschool or childcare in general, because the requirements for returning to basically, like, they're way stricter than our jobs are now. So it's not like, oh, you get COVID 5 days after you feel like you can go back to work. It's like, you could get COVID, they ain't going to school for 2 weeks. So it is and then you have to use your vacation time or babysitters. So we're like, hey, well, this is, for once I knew I have it before the rest of my family. We were like, let's just have you go to a motel so we don't infect us. So here I am, motel.
Which is really a difficult thing. I know how Tony is going crazy right now because we are both active outdoorsy people. Even if that doesn't mean I'm going, like, hiking every day, I crave being outside and moving around. And I know that, I guess, now I'm conscious that I'm rubbing this in. But yeah, Tony, hopefully you'll be out of there soon and get to have some fresh air and see your family, of course, also.
Thank you. Yeah. And, it's just, but if I was home, then I can't really go out no matter what, but if I was home, then, like, it's so hard to keep even if I was quarantined in one room, it's so hard to keep a 3-year-old away from seeing you, which is the saddest part. I miss my baby girl.
Yeah. I totally get it. I quarantined at the beginning of the pandemic when I guess Gilda was really little, like basically a baby. And I was sort of like waved to them I was on the third floor of our twin house. It's that when I say 3 floors, it might, for a lot of people around the country or the world, it might conjure up the sense of some massive house. But in a lot of Philadelphia, the row houses and twins are narrow and tall. And so I was in the bedroom on the third floor, like waving to everybody down the stairs. And and that was no fun at all. And then my wife, our positions reversed, I think a year later. It sucks. But we'll take what we can, which is the opportunity to record a podcast episode.
I think we should do this more often. I think I've always thought that, we need to have more podcasts of just us talking and not guests. But then I think, like, we don't really activate on that. And then the other thing is, scheduling with adding a third just seems like a layer of complexity that seems like out of reach for, like, busy parent lives right now.
Happening a lot is that Tony or I will interview somebody and have that be an episode, but then Tony and I will be on episodes talking together. The 3-person episode might be the hardest to do. Tony's like, hey, let's podcast. I'm stuck in a hotel room. And I was like, what are we going to talk about? Tony mentioned one of our mutual favorite topics, which is, I think you put it in your text, marmots. And we will let people in this side of who know the United States ponder for a second what we're going to talk about when we say urban marmots.
Right. And the other thing is just, we could broaden it towards marmots, but it's marmots brought to our attention by kind of really getting intimate with iNaturalist and thinking about like having it as much as we like to think about urban wild, you know, that we're experts at urban wildlife and that we're not biased towards, you know, certain taxa or biased by certain housing or whatever, like, and then that might, you know, have us kind of think about, you know, species, whatever, but it's interesting to kind of look for what you don't expect and see and really go down the rabbit holes of different taxa and seeing where wildlife is being found within city limits, like, you know, interfacing with curbs and backyards and, you know, fences and whatnot, like, rather than, you know, and not just, you know, just in the green spaces within a city. It's, yeah, and it's interesting how some species will be found in cities universally, and for some, you know, throughout the range, they might not be in cities, and then one city, for some reason, they occur in that city. You know,
yeah, totally.
What you think about it, what you think they're going to be within city limits, being observed within city limits, those conditions should be more uniform across the range, but you know, in some cases, it's not, and it's only a couple of cities.
And I also say, like something I've noticed was the inconsistency of marmot urbanization, that one species in particular does show up a lot around cities. And I was sitting there looking at marmot records that I naturalist in Europe and Asia and not seeing a heck of a lot of urban crossover there. As usual, you can reach out to us at urbanwildlifecast@gmail.com. We're not super fast on the replies these days, but have some patience. Bug us if you want. That's cool. We won't hold it against you. If you have any ideas or want to come on the podcast or have some suggestions. The other thing I want to do is mention some Patreon donors we got. On Patreon, I'm having a little trouble figuring out who is current. It looks like a bunch of people are current, which is awesome. And even if they're not, here's a bunch of people who are recent, and that's great too. We've got Susan Blancett, Anna W., Paula Gaber, Aniela Ross, Hugs for Bugs. It's a great name. Dean Barada, Dawn Weber, and Sandy Brubaker. So thanks to everybody who has ever given us money on Patreon. You know, I think Patreon's a way that producers, artists, et cetera, can make money off of what they're doing. We're not really making money in the net sense of it all, but a few dollars does help to do things like defray the hosting costs and things like that, so that we're, you know, we're not quitting our day jobs to podcast, but every little bit actually does help and makes this something we can keep on doing. And then I'll put in a couple pitches. I'll mention that my book, Exploring Philly Nature, A Guide for All Four Seasons, is still totally buyable in case you haven't gotten it yet. Maybe we'll have to cut this out. I don't know. Tony, do you want to mention your progress towards authoring a book?
Yeah, I'm still in the discussions with a publisher, and basically going so well that I decided to start writing the book, and I'm like 70 pages in easy, so why not?
That's awesome, man. That's so awesome. Yeah. It's the fun part. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that that pretty soon we'll have a Tony book also. And it can be, it's funny, as now that I've done this, the writing is a lot of fun. You finish it, and then you don't realize how much time it's going to take beyond that. And so it can be...
I have put out some albums. So
actually, that's a good point. Yeah.
Whatever it's longer or, yeah, curious it'll be the same or longer turn out time.
It reminds me that like a book, even though it seems like a very solo activity, if it's one author, it is still very much a collective effort. You've got a whole team of people who edit it a couple ways, help with laying it out, doing the artwork, doing the graphics, doing the marketing, all the business stuff that we don't usually think about. And so it all those people have to do their parts also for a book to come out, unless I guess you're self-publishing, and then it's a whole other ball of wax. And I almost forgot to mention my Substack. You can find more nature writing if you want more nature writing at Where the Brown Snakes Roam, as the Substack I put out every week about just nature in Philadelphia, but trying to get into some broader themes for the natural world. So it isn't just like inside Philly stuff, but broader nature writing using Philly as the setting. And so that's the idea behind Where the Brown Snakes Roam. Please check it out on Substack and subscribe. Thanks. Why don't we jump into the topic? And I think now could be the big reveal in the episode. When we're talking about marmots, we are including one of our favorite, our favorite squirrel, which is a large ground squirrel. Tony, would you like to reveal what we're talking about?
The woodchuck or groundhog or whistle pig. I think, you know, definitely top 10 national, like most charismatic North American, or specifically, you know, of the United States animals, you know, like to think about, like, you know, like that a rodent, you know, I mean, that's not a beaver, because, like, you know, obviously beavers are, you know, they chew down, you know, they're extra, you know, they have the tail, they have, you know, they have
a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a lot to, like, you know, make you want to put, you know, more beavers in pop culture, but, like, you know, or like have significance, you know, along with eagles and bears and, you know, white-tailed deer and things like that. But, like,
and beavers, I think, are huge. They can get to be like as big as a medium-sized dog. So they've got,
yeah,
that too.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, the groundhog, you know, we just had Groundhog's Day. In fact, actually,
I think it's tomorrow.
No, tomorrow's Groundhog's Day.
Yeah, they've got some cultural significance there.
Sometimes people call other species of ground squirrel, or even groundhogs, you know, they'll call them gophers. I was just wondering about, like, in some ways, is Bill Murray involved in two movies with groundhogs?
That is a question, because I've thought about that when, and it maybe out in the Midwest or the West, there are gophers that actually cause problems in golf courses.
Oh, I went down that rabbit hole too. There are plenty that cause problems. In, yeah.
That gopher hole. But yeah, and just some quick notes on their names. The groundhog and whistle pig are pretty obvious when you see one, especially towards the fall when they get really fat. And then they'll do an alert whistle, when danger or predator is nearby. The woodchuck is, an indigenous term for them that got adopted into English. Apparently monax was another one. Both of these are from groups that were living in the north, what is now the northeast of the United States, Algonquin,
right?
Languages, yeah. And so I was always wondering, why is it Marmota monax? And so that's where that monax comes from. It's another indigenous name for him. Charismatic, man. I find myself liking them. But every time I get a good look at one, I'm like, what a dopey looking animal. Because they've got like the severe, like, buck tooth look with, yeah, their big incisors that stick out. And they just kind of have this like, huh, look to them. And I think of one in particular. You know, I think I've talked about this in the podcast. And if you know me, you probably expect this. I have a game camera that I sometimes point out at the alley. Like, I have a really narrow alley behind my house and through the middle of the block, which is basically impassable for humans because of how much overgrowth there's been that other people on the block haven't been doing their jobs of maintaining their sections. But in any case, animals can get back and forth. So I'll put a game camera back there, and you can see mostly possums, raccoons, and outdoor cats, which always gets me a little mad. There's plenty of birds that show up, usually house sparrows. And squirrels, of course, make an appearance. But like last year or year before, I forget which, a groundhog showed up. You know, Tony knows my block. We've got not a lot of open space near my house. That thing had to have come from 3 or 4 blocks away. I think more like 10 blocks away, to be totally honest, which was a bit of a hike for a little animal like that, and a lot of streets it had to cross. And I think that's, without realizing it, I think I'm segueing into their habitat. If you're not familiar with groundhogs or woodchucks, they are creatures of open space, although open space with some break in the open space. for me, a classic ground or woodchuck or groundhog spot is you've got a field and then you've got like the edge of the woods, and or you've got a building like a barn, and then their burrow will be at least one of their burrows will be out at the edge under some like gnarly down tree or something like that, or under the foundation of the barn or the building. And then they'll sort of be able to get out in the field, do their thing, gather their food, and then have sort of a more fortress kind of burrow arrangement under the structure. And so you could use both. And they're classically thought of as a creature of the suburbs and rural areas, where you'll have them, you know, just in farm country. They can do a number on soybean crops, apparently, if there's a lot of them. They do like eating beans. In urban settings, I've been getting turned on to them recently where, frankly, just vacant lots, like a big enough vacant lot in Philadelphia will not always, but will often have groundhogs. And you don't expect it, but you talk to the neighbors. I was visiting a school in North Philly last summer, and they're like, oh yeah, you want to see our groundhog burrow? And I was like, what are you talking about? And so like, they showed me right there under the edge of the school, like the burrow was going back under the school. And across the street, there's a few vacant lots that they had turned into some garden space, you know, here and there. And you were, I don't know, two blocks away from railroad tracks, which is like a big wildlife corridor kind of feature. And that's all that those things needed. And I contemplated whether like those animals are part of a sustaining population, or I guess the way to think of it is, are those vacant lot groundhogs part of a population sink or source?
Right.
So are they sort of trickling out of better habitat, finding their vacant lot, but then getting killed by a car or by a dog or something? And then what do you know? Another groundhog makes it out after being kicked out by its parents or by its mom, and finds that vacant lot, and it just repeats. That would be a population sink. In other words, it's sort of taking animals out of the overall population. But if it's a source, that means they're breeding there and producing enough offspring that survive that they can then themselves leave and go find new territory. And so it's a, so when you find animals in urban settings, your impulse can be like, oh, how great, they're living here. But your next question should be, well, are they doing okay? Or is this like kind of like a trap for them?
Yeah. Classic sink and source. I often use, pileate woodpeckers as an example of that. Again, I'm not saying they're one or the other. I have a suspicion, but
well, what's your suspicion? Woodpecker.
I think that they're, probably not breeding in pocket parks. They're breeding in Wissahickon or bigger contiguous areas, and then that's a source and there's a sink. But maybe I could be wrong. I think, you know, I just don't imagine there's enough big standing trees that they, you know, for them to, you know, find enough, you know, beetle larvae or whatever, and you know, they need bigger timber to use. So I think more like a big old suburb would be more likely to hold them than they might take those trees down though, than a small park. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I'll present sort of another on the groundhog part, that they, on the one hand, they're sort of trading mortality, like that they're going to get run over by cars a lot more in a city. Maybe dogs will go after them, but they don't. They might not have other predators. Although, as soon as I'm saying that, I'm like, well, they got red-tailed hawks in the city. You probably have foxes around there. Well, I don't have one on my block, but they're pretty common around this.
When they're young cats, for sure.
When they're young cats, for sure. The interesting wrinkle is coyotes, where we certainly have coyotes in Philadelphia, but as far as I can tell, they aren't as abundant as they are in lots of other cities around the country, like Atlanta or Chicago, or like especially at West Phoenix or something like that. So I don't know. And coyotes are like the classic nemesis of the groundhogs. I was just checking a study where it was in 1995 in Pennsylvania. They're studying coyotes' stomach contents, I guess. And when you're looking at how much of what's in a coyote's stomach, the leading contender was white-tailed deer, and that very well was probably scavenged white-tailed deer, which is a whole other topic of coyotes and deer, but we're not going to get into that. And then also smaller mammals than you might think for a coyote, like mice and voles and stuff like that. And then
you got to watch. They got to watch. Oh, what's the Fairly Mo book about when the guy's in?
He's in the Arctic, and he's had that wolf that keeps eating lemmings.
Well, then he eats lemmings to see if figures he's roughly wolf size. Is he? You know,
that's a classic movie. We got to figure out what it was. And then, but coming in third in coyote stomach contents was a tie between basically cottontail rabbits and groundhogs. The study had the basic classic name, some observations on coyote food habits in Pennsylvania. In the Journal of the Pennsylvania Academy of Science, 1995, by G.W. Whitmer, M.J. Pipus, and A. Hayden. And to the coyote point, when Tony and I were growing up, let's say in the 80s and 90s, I bet if we drove by a field and waited a minute, we'd see a ton of groundhogs. And I think of this, I grew up in Central Ohio, and I think of you'd see a bunch of them, like wherever you went.
And you almost got, you kind of like knew to scan the edges to see one running, you know, you're just so used to it, you know?
Yeah. And then when I've been chatting up, a topic of interest of mine is how wildlife affect, impact farmers. It's a whole other topic, not really urban. Although we're going to get into an urban angle of this in a little bit. When I talk to farmers, they'll be like, okay, so I'm just curious, you know, like what is it that is a pain in your behinds? Like what's eating your crops? And, at least in Southeast PA, you know, deer come in number one, of things that farmers see as a pest for eating their food or eating their crops. And when I asked about what about groundhogs, the answer has been, well, there's not so many anymore since coyotes got really common in Southeast PA. That in the around the turn of the century, like around 2000 or the late 90s into there, coyotes got a lot, sort of had finished moving into rural southeastern Pennsylvania. And then they saw the groundhog numbers, the woodchuck numbers, drop after that. They just weren't quite so common, and they weren't really a pest anymore. They're sort of around the edges here and there. Sometimes a pain if they're digging holes under your buildings, but not like they used to be. And that's something that I've heard mentioned in sort of hunting discussions about woodchucks. And I don't know that that's like a problem. I don't think, like, I'm not worried about woodchuck populations. There's still plenty of them around. They seem to have taken a hit from the coyotes becoming more abundant, because before that, there really wasn't a predator that could, a common predator that would take out an adult groundhog. Like a 7-pound, 6-pound groundhog is probably out of the range for a red-tailed hawk, you think?
Yeah, and red tails and gray horns, or you know, gray horns maybe take a little bit bigger prey, but pretty similar.
Yeah, and they're sort of outclassing the foxes at that point. Whereas you know, a 30-pound coyote can take them on, and so that's been the real difference. And it's something that when people are trying to control groundhogs for reasons we might get into in a little bit, it's really hard to do. They're just like, they're persistent. They're fecund. They keep coming back. Apparently the way to really control them is to have a dog around. Like a medium sized or large dog will have a blast chasing groundhogs and catching some of them and maybe killing them. And the groundhogs know to respect a dog. They recognize that as something to stay away from. So it's sort of like one solution. If a groundhog's your problem is having a dog in the space sort of patrolling and running around.
Yeah, I've had, you know, people call facilities I've worked at, not understanding that, like, you know, wildlife, both institutions I've worked for, government institutions I've worked for, like, you know, it's the government. They think that, you know, if something's in an animal's in their yard, it's either Fish and Wildlife Service, the Park Service, whatever, you know, whatever entity they think of, they're like, you have to come and handle this, and groundhogs is like the number one thing they call about. And I remember one woman was very upset, like, she's like, it's my yard. I'm like, you go off and say, hey, groundhog in my yard. I was like, that's awesome. I like, couldn't help myself. She's like, no, it's not. I'm like, and I'm like, she's like, what should I do about it? I was like, be excited. They're cool. She's like, well, is it going to hurt my, you know, my golden retriever? I'm like, you're an 80-pound golden retriever, like, descendant from his natural predator. Like, really? Come on. Like, no.
No.
Go, you know, like,
they can be tough on a garden, man. There's a great section of a book that I love. I'm not a Michael Pollan fan, most of his books. He's got some articles that are classics. But the book I do love is called Second Nature. It was sort of like before he really blew up and started telling everybody how to eat. And it was basically a book about gardening and sort of the relationship to nature and sort of approaching how we look at the natural world as a sort of a hands-on gardening perspective, more than just a hands-off preservationist kind of perspective. But and he has a classic section about his battles with a groundhog and his place in Connecticut, where he'd plant stuff and the groundhogs would just like mow it down. And he got to the point of pouring gasoline down the burrow and lighting a match and even that not getting rid of the groundhogs. Because, you know, they'll have like sort of complex multiple burrow exits and, you know, I'm sure as soon as they smell the gas fumes, they're out of the other exit of the burrow. But they can be a real pain that way. And that actually leads me to, we'll get into this discussion, which Tony and I don't say we're disagreeing on it because I'm on the fence about it, but like, when is it justifiable to try to kill the groundhogs? And so I'll give you two urban situations, and I'm going to back up a second. And I'll say that I have not found anyone who will admit on the record to killing groundhogs in the city of Philadelphia. Or frankly, other cities I've talked to, people who are involved in some kind of land management or urban farming role. I have also, though, heard tons of stories from different people about how they have killed groundhogs in these spaces. And some of these are, let's say, in like a park or a cemetery kind of setting, where you're concerned about, damage from a, aesthetic perspective, or a structural perspective, I guess, in a way. Like if you're in a cemetery, you don't want groundhogs digging into people's graves and sort of excavating parts. And then people who are engaged in urban agriculture or urban, which however you want to call it, farming, gardening. But that problem where the groundhog will come in and just mow down all the lettuce you just planted and you're hoping to sell at the farmer's market. I was sort of thinking, well, I guess I get it. This question of when is it justifiable to kill wildlife? And Tony came down very, I think, strongly against it. So Tony, what were you thinking?
I generally think you should avoid, killing native wildlife, that you don't intend to eat during hunting season as much as possible. And if there's a conflict, if anybody's ever had a mouse infestation, I had one because someone scared the crap out of me about preparing for COVID and, shut down everything that I started prepping even more.
You got into your bit of rice or something?
I just had I bought a lot of stuff before I put it in the airtight containers and stuff for, perpetuity. And all it takes is like one, whatever. And then we had a bit of infestation and, I did my due diligence when I realized what was happening. I put my food away, but we still decided to call an exterminator. The thing that maybe really want to use one was kind of how they explained they go for cultural controls first. They trained in figuring out what you had a thought about and finding like entry points that like you wouldn't even realize. And then, you know, so their whole thing is, you know, we can put traps, we can poison if you want, but like, if you don't, like, you just got to make sure you prevent them from getting in and that there's nothing for them to get into when they're in, basically, you know? And like, that is like, and so, I mean, it's the same thing how people kill, it drives me crazy, I'm sure does Billy too, when people kill rat snakes getting in their chicken coops and whatnot. And I'm like, get finer wire, you know? Like, get a finer grid of wire and make sure you have it tight. Like, then you won't have rat snakes. You know,
see, I have a fantasy of moving to the country and getting chickens for the sole purpose of attracting rat snakes.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I got his, like, I think I kicked off a, like, leftist, like, prepping kind of site because they were, like, you know, people would brag about the rat snakes they killed. And I'm like, you know, oh, it's cool that your hobby, you know, made you kill two, you know, and they're like, it's not a hobby. I'm like, yeah, it is. You can go to a store and just buy everything, right? You know, right now. Like,
but what about when the shit hits the fan, like, Tony?
Yeah, like, yeah, it's like, whatever. Like, I mean, I think this wasn't even like, survivalist. It was more like, being an alternate or just like kind of like being, you know, having the skills of, I'm like, dude, just, you know, you don't need to be doing this. Like,
yeah,
you know, society's most likely, like, it's pretty, like, I'll admit that, like, I think having some stuff is reasonable, you know, 72 hours for sure, a month maybe. But I think, like, if society, like, I think that the chance society is really going to be not functioning longer than, like, where you can't get what you need longer than a month, I think is if you're going to prepare for that, I think it could, you could really make an argument that's so unrealistic that's a hobby. You know, preparing for something.
I agree 100%. I think well, also, yeah, there's something very American about the assumption that if there is a big crisis, it'll be, like, independent, like, skill and preparation that will save you versus community connections and, like, sort of your social networks. Like, that will be how we take care of each other will be more important than, like, hunkering down in your bunker. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I would want other people who don't, you know, I work for, you know, a municipal government. I don't expect to be doing what I do when there's a disaster or something that comes. But, like, if something major happened that was really like, okay, like, things are now different from now on, you know, maybe currency doesn't work. Like, who knows? That kind of, like, event where you're like, okay, now we're in this, or, you know, whatever. I don't think my first reaction would be to flee. I think my first reaction would be like, okay, I'm going to work. You know, I'm going to go to, like, the nearest place I think my fellow civil servants would gather and be like, I'm here to work. Like, what are we doing? How are we feeding people? How are we getting clean water? Like, I think that's my first reaction, you know, would be. Then go, you know, remove myself from the situation and, like, think I'm going to be better off. Like, figuring it out. I think people are going to figure out how to get things back online quicker than you're going to figure out how to survive on your own.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I think, you know, it's funny, like, people always talk about, like, foraging and whatnot. And I'm like, you're not, you know, and it comes up, and, you know, and I'm like, you're not surviving unless, like, do you know what animals look like? It's like, name some animals that are that, you know, weigh what a human weighs, you know, or, you know, even a little bit less, and what do they look like? What do they all have in common? And, like, and, you know, that you don't think eats any meat, right? Like, not a chimpanzee, because we know they eat a whole lot of meat. So think about, like, what are other animals that are, you know, at least 70 pounds, even, you know, what do they look, you know, hell, sometimes even less than that. Like, think about groundhogs. What does a groundhog look like? Every one of those animals has a massive, massive belly full of, or, you know, containing at least one, if not multiple stomachs full of, like, of bacteria to dissolve, to consume leaves. Like, that's how you get, if you're a vegan, you have a massive gut that can process leaves. If you don't have that, you're going to supplement, you know, by meat, you know, like.
Well, but also so. Just that, I mean, I want to try to get us off this track in a sec, but when you look at sort of the figures for hunter-gatherer societies and what their population density is, it is shockingly low. Like, we could sit here and say, oh, you can eat cattail tubers, and you can harvest mussels, and you can hunt deer and collect the eggs from ducks. I don't know. But in practice, like, foraging, like, before agriculture, when you read about, like, let's say Paleo-Indian or pre-agricultural people in this part of the country before, like, yeah, before agriculture, in an area of, like, a city like Philadelphia, you might have had, like, a couple dozen people, like, yeah, not 1.5 million getting by on foraging. Yeah.
And we outnumber deer, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We're not gonna be able to get that kind of, you know, we need agri, you know,
our culture, population density need, is not sustainable without agriculture. Just, it is not.
Right. And even if, you know, I'm not saying for corn, it's the cattle and everything, you know, all that. Like, we need, like, that's how you get, you know, and
yeah.
So,
well, I'm trying to come up with a good segue to groundhogs.
Well, thinking about, you know, big things that live in the urban area without going to grocery stores. What do they eat? They have the gut to eat all the grass. It's all the grass.
And something I'll point out, like they are not regarded today as something you hunt to eat, but I'd say that's a recent perception of groundhogs, that you look them up, people do talk about eating them more recently and saying, wait, actually they taste good.
Yes.
But they, Tony had your great story about possums. And everybody's got to love somebody. And you're talking about basically someone saying he was going to eat a possum that you found dead. There's sort of like a, it's a, I think the recent rise in the abundance of white-tailed deer, that has become like the mammal people hunt to eat, in this part of the country. And people forgot that up until like 100 years ago, people were also eating groundhogs and possums and raccoons.
We're 40 minutes in. We haven't even talked about the other marmots.
So that's just a little touch, a note about groundhogs. And I'm not expecting everybody to go out and eat a groundhog, but just sort of putting them out there as a game animal. And I'll point out that in Pennsylvania, there's like two animals that have a season year round, maybe a couple others, but crows, for some reason, I still don't understand, maybe because they're considered an agricultural pest. And probably for the same reason, groundhogs, you can go basically all year in the summer when you're not hunting anything else legally, and hunt groundhogs. Exactly. We didn't get to the other marmots. There are 15 species of marmots around the world. By my count, six of them are in North America, including the woodchuck. And most of the rest are, like, they look like mountain species, Tony, like the yellow-bellied and hoary marmots. And then when I was looking, you know, I started looking around Europe and Asia, and it seems like they also stick more to mountainous areas. I don't know. What else do we know about?
To me, until I really went down the rabbit hole,
you keep saying rabbit hole, Tony. It's got to be a woodchuck hole.
Yeah, it was down the marmot hole. Oh, and by the way, you know, Big Lebowski, it's as funny that movie is, as classic it is a shame that they refer to a European ferret as a nice marmot.
Very different animals.
And aquatic, is neither, you know, European ferrets or marmots are aquatic. We're talking about yellow-bellied marmots, yep, living in cities in And so, what I think it is I always thought marmots were alpine or tundra, like they're above tree line and, or they're in tundra, but, there are also some more like rocky, marmots are more in rocky areas. Right. So there are more like lower level. I mean, granted, some of these cities are quite high, you know, but they're not like above tree line high, but there are some, you know,
like Salt Lake City seems to have some, Seattle, I think, when I was poking around.
Vancouver. Yeah. Seattle, Vancouver, and some in like, Denver. I mean, Denver, Boulder, more like Boulder. I mean, there are some for Denver and, like Fort Collins, but you know, I mean, there are plenty, you know, there are, you know, a few elbow marmots. Looks like there's, I would say five easily you can count in actual, like, ones in a park. Another additional ones in a park, and there's one like right on the, you know, with, I don't think it's Denver anymore, but I see there's a good four, you know, really urban, you know, Denver, records. And then, you know, Denver is basically, it's basically like city and suburbs from Cheyenne down to like Colorado Springs, almost. They call it like the Front Range. You know, it's like one city in Wyoming and like, you know, a bunch. It's like, they call it like the Front Range metropolitan area. That area tends to get some urban Rocky Mountain stuff, to, you know, or even plains, you know, stuff, because it's right on the edge.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about iNaturalist is often you think it's a city, it just happens to be, you think that they're in the city, it just happens to be, you're seeing a really dense area of sightings, and you're thinking that they're in the city, but what it is when you zoom in, you realize nothing's actually in a city. It's just the density of observers leaving a city and observing these things is the closest place they are, and it you know, makes you think that they're associated with the city, but they're really just not. It's probably just, you know, they don't live in a city, but people, because it's a densely populated area, you know, people, there's going to be more people observing than on the outskirts and outside of it, you know, that farther away. But then you get surprised and you zoom in and there's like, there actually are marmots in, you know, in the streets and you know, backyards and are like, or perched up on like a, you know, set on a concrete, you know, park railing, you know, yes, Spokane. I think is it Boise too? I definitely Spokane. Let me just see Boise. But yeah, and Albuquerque. I got to look at Albuquerque. Albuquerque. No, well, no, there is. Yeah, there's one yellow-bellied marmot in Albuquerque, and that in the picture is like straight up, like, you know, it's in someone's house or whatever. It looks like Santa Fe as well. but Albuquerque, Salt Lake City. Those are two cities that often have pretty unique urban wildlife, as you can imagine. And then Phoenix and Tucson is ridiculous. There's so many things that if you're looking at urban wildlife that, you know, they're plenty urban, they're definitely urban in there. And they're, but a lot of herps. There's a lot of like backyard.
And I think if we got into Phoenix, the non-mountainous areas out west, you've got a lot of urban a lot of urban prairie dogs, and other ground squirrels. And so I'm wondering if maybe, out east, the sort of your open space, big ground squirrels are the woodchucks, but out west, it's more that they're the communal, slightly smaller, prairie.
Well, I mean, see, it's the reason that there's a higher, is a more of a diversity of burrowing animals. Well, I mean, we have shrews and voles and stuff in here, but like, there's in an open area, you know, wildlife tends to be, I mean, they have to either, you know, they have to burrow or get, you know, really low to the ground because there's nowhere else for them to go. So it would stand to reason that those areas are going to have a more species that burrow, therefore more, you know, burrowing animals in people's yards, you know?
Yeah.
Even a predator that goes after them out there, you know, like that burrow that goes, you dig after the badger, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and I'm sure there's plenty, and herps that, you know, are predatory, you know, too.
Oh, yeah.
So, but so, you know, it makes sense that you're going to have a higher, you know, but, in the East is going to, you know, we don't have nearly the room for them. And it's, you know, and also it's probably why there's less coyotes. I mean, could just be that there's less coyotes in Philly, even over here. It's just that, I know we talk about how Philadelphia is like our suburbs look a lot like other cities. Like our suburbs is like the density of other cities, residential housing. You know what I mean? Like our, like the density of, you know, in Midwest, in most of the countries, like, don't have the density of housing that the East Coast does, actually in a city. And so there's two things there. We're like, there's not, the surface area for, you know, coyotes do burrow a lot. There's not the surface area to burrow. It's not like, so that provide things. But then like, but the suburbs don't have like quite the density of like human resources for coyotes to take advantage of her. You know what I mean? Sometimes there's that input of like garbage and litter and just like,
apparently,
you know,
apparently they eat a lot of fruit from people's gardens though, out in the suburbs.
Yeah. But,
and cat food.
But, right. But, and a lot of other, but the thing about, those other cities that are different than our suburbs is that they actually have the restaurants and the, you know, all the garbage and everything, but they also have the yards and everything. So they have like the input human resources and the suburban single house kind of, so they have like more space, but they still have access to a lot of the same resources and density. So I think that kind of changes the equation. You know, why there's, you know, they could be so dense in some of these cities because, and also there's observed more because of the people here, but out here, I think just the amount of heart space is limiting in what they can, they can realize.
Yeah. Cool. No, so I think if you're somewhere outside of the range of the woodchuck, whether that's whether it's North America, whether that's in Eurasia, and you have urban marmots, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear about it. And
let's talk about gophers too. I mean, I am burying animals in general, but like gophers are much smaller, and they, I think, you know, it'd be interesting to hear people talk about their relationship with gophers because, you know, they're in Florida and in like Georgia, and then they're like in the Midwest, but they're not, you know, they're really not in the, you know, in the, from the visit,
we don't have from New England. Yeah, it's something that confused me for a while because, elsewhere in the continent, there's a genus of snakes that everybody finds appealing, except, I mean, unless you don't like snakes, and it's called the genus is Pituophis, the common names for these snakes vary depending where you are. Out west, they're usually called gopher snakes. And out east, we've got pine snakes, and in the Midwest and upper Midwest up into the Great Plains, not upper Midwest, let's say Great Plains, Midwest, yeah, Illinois, and then west and north, you've got bull snakes, like the bova, like B-U-L-L, bull snakes. And so they are all burrowing, big constrictors, and out west, bull snakes and gopher snakes are like the name implies. They're classic. Like they eat a whole lot of pocket gophers. They eat a whole lot of gophers. Yeah. And out east, I was like, I had assumed that we had gophers because we have pine snakes. In New Jersey and then in south, in sort of piney habitat south from New Jersey. But we don't. They just eat other burrowing small mammals out here. But yeah, if you're into the Midwest and then west across the country, it's also in Florida. Now that I'm looking at distribution maps for pocket gophers.
Yeah.
You've got lots of gophers down there, and they are a funky looking little creature.
The Caddyshack gopher is clearly a groundhog.
Yeah.
You know, because gophers are very, very small, and, you know, they're a tenth to 20th or less the mass of a groundhog. They're,
that's like a hamster-sized critter.
Yeah, and they have oversized claws. They don't have that cute face. They have a longer, narrow tail. The Kadjiak gopher is clearly, you know. But remember, these aren't gophers. They're pocket gophers.
Yeah, there's a classic, back when forums were a big thing, there is a forum for field herping, looking for reptiles and amphibians outside. Someone had picked up a board and like you do looking for snakes and had found a pocket gopher, and the little thing had, I mean, of course it was scared out of its mind, but it had its claws up. It's like looking at the camera. It's got these giant incisors. And I still remember the caption was just like, "In it to win it." And it was like, because that little gopher, it was committed to the fight. And of course it survived that encounter because, you know, it was not a coyote finding it or a fox, but yeah, they're small but mighty little creatures. And they, I guess they are a real pain for gardeners and people who want lawns to look nice. Who want lawns to look nice per the like sort of socially expected uniform monotony of the suburban lawn or golf course. That's not what Tony and I tend to find nice. Do you want to mention your company name?
Yeah, when I used to consulting, my company was Marmota Consulting because I just I love groundhogs so much. People expect me to be all about birds, and I am, but it's just kind of too obvious, and I just really do love groundhogs.
Awesome. No, I love them too. I don't have quite Tony's attachment, but they are, as I've seen them in more and more inarguably urban settings. Like we always talk about how, you know, different definitions of what urban is exactly. But if you're in row house, North Philly, in a vacant lot, I don't know what else you can call that. That's pretty much as urban as it gets. Short of high rise neighborhoods and in other parts of the city, or like Hong Kong or something, where there's not much green in the residential areas. But that's still pretty solidly urban. Point being, they have gone from being my the fringe of the urban or the parks around the city, or I remember I see a ton of them, Tony, on railroad embankments on the regional rail. No, was it regional rail?
Yeah, absolutely.
That, but also another regional line, the Norristown High Speed Line. But these sort of above ground commuter rail lines, and you're going through a wooded park or neighborhood, but along the railroad track, you got these banks, embankments on either side. And I was just looking at them, and you can see them, especially in the winter or early in the spring, especially when they start getting active, because you got a lot of fresh soil in the apron right at the bottom of the burrow. And so if you're going along and you're like me or Tony, and you're looking out the window of your commuter rail train and looking for an animal while you're riding in the train, you're like, groundhog burrow, groundhog burrow, groundhog burrow, groundhog burrow, as you know. That now I see them in vacant lots in the city. I believe it more and more. And I'll say, I got to give credit to some kids I was with, had to be 15 years ago. There was a local garden where a retired, retired microbiologist, but avid gardener, had taken some local kids under her wings and was gardening with them. And she asked me to come take them out looking for critters and stuff. And we're walking, and I'll tell Tony where this is, 46th and Market, going past the elevated train station there. And this is there are some fields around, big vacant lots, but it's still pretty thoroughly urban area. And these kids were like, Mr. Billy, we see like there's something we saw. I'm like, well, what'd you see? And they're like, well, it was kind of like the size of a cat. I'm like, well, was it a cat? They're like, no, not a cat. It's not a dog, not a dog. And we're going through all the options. And I was like, they must have seen a groundhog, but they could not have seen a groundhog. That's impossible. You know, there are no groundhogs right here. And I saw, I think, another one in a different similar area shortly after. And I was like, man, those kids are right. They totally saw a groundhog. Groundhogs are now thoroughly part of my urban bestiary of Philadelphia. And I'm kind of missing them. All this talk about groundhogs in February is rough, Tony.
I know. It's funny. It's too perfect for the Groundhog Day tomorrow. Although this will probably air for a couple of days.
We'll have just missed Groundhog Day, which is a tradition that apparently hails from like Central Europe, with like bears and stuff, like the other creatures that hibernate or kind of hibernate. I know there's a technical definition of hibernation that bears don't meet, but still kind of close to it. And that got imported to the United States with immigrants from Central Europe, and it sort of got applied to another hibernating animal, basically, from bears and whatnot to woodchucks and to groundhogs. And they, I always feel bad for those poor groundhogs that get yanked out of their enclosures and held up to the cameras. Although they're living the good life, they get food and shelter from coyotes. So what you're thinking about groundhogs or the Groundhog Day, watching the movie, which is a fun movie, you know,
I mean, it's classic. It's Andy, you know, like, my best friend, you know, guitar player Rambo, like he, you know, he's a very successful cinematographer in Los Angeles, and it's one of his absolute favorite movies. It's a brilliant piece of filmmaking and a great moral.
Yep. You know? Keep an eye out for the real animal. And if you do see a groundhog, get a picture, put it on iNaturalist. You know, I encourage everybody, set up a game camera in your backyard. You never know what's going to walk by there when you're not looking.
If anybody knows anything about Putin's tigers, give us a call too.
Wait, real quick. What is that about?
About Putin. The one thing, I guess, you know, we can agree that he was a good thing. He wasn't, like, more or less, I guess, was interested in, you know, reduction efforts and you know, population rebuilding of the Amur tiger or the Siberian tiger. But apparently, you know, they almost doubled in size in like 10 years. And now they're having, there's been people killed and you know, dogs killed and, you know, in towns, you know, like not just in the countryside, like actually in towns in
people in Russia. Towns or the dogs in towns? That article that you sent, I thought the people thing, it wasn't clear whether that was like out in the boonies.
I think both, but they definitely been getting people like not just like someone walking in like a forest reserve, like someone in a rural area, like, got you it. Know, like
you yeah, that's no joke, man. So, that is awful. I think the dog size, I'm not so broken up about it. Also, just because out in a lot of places in the world, there are, the dog populations aren't a bunch of pets that get walked on leashes. They're, you sort of have this like gradient from like what Europeans and Americans think of as how dogs should be kept to totally stray dogs, and a lot of dogs in between that are kind of fed and cared for, but aren't like exactly owned. And so all of those dogs end up being a great food resource for a big predator, like a leopard in India or a tiger in Siberia.
Yeah. A lot of places in the world, people don't really go to the pet store or, you know, to get a dog, like a puppy or just like a dog just kind of eventually shows up at your house. I'm not exaggerating. I was talking to people in Brazil about this. Like, no, they don't really get dogs, you know, like, you know, like, it's always kind of like find us, and you just end up kind of like have one or two or four, you know? Yeah. And like, they're like, and they go like, and my friend in Belize was the same way. Like, he had his dogs, but like, it wasn't like he even like, you know, he didn't have to tell anybody to like feed him or like take care of him when he was away. They just like hung out with his neighbors until he came back, you know? Like, they, you know, and vice versa. When I was there, his neighbor's dog, he's like, these are my dogs, these are my neighbors. You know, I was like, what?
Okay. Yeah, we'll say that's not necessarily a good thing. It's a recipe for rabies, and it's a And those dogs, where they are like that, are a big problem for wildlife.
Yeah.
But I think it's a topic for another day is how our first world American, European, like, pet culture is a new thing, and it is not how most humans on Earth interact with the pet species that in our society we think of almost as family members. You know, that like if you went back 100 years, you wouldn't have hardly any dogs living in houses, maybe 150 years, but and there's been a progression from dogs being like not exactly owned. Maybe you had one or two dogs, but there's other dogs that hung around, to like having a dog in your yard in a doghouse, to having a dog permitted in the house, to having a dog actually sleeping in your bed. And that's like, that's been or you could do the same thing with cats. That's a new thing. Around the world, most dogs around the world are not what, if you saw them in the States, you'd think it was a stray dog or a dog that was being horribly neglected by its owners. I was in both Mexico and Bolivia, saw that kind of dog gradient where people might have a really fancy breed, like a big German Shepherd or something like that, that they kept in their family compound. Because people don't really have like houses with lawns. They have like walled or fenced in compounds with multiple buildings and with a garden in the middle. And so you might have your fancy dog in there, but then like Tony was saying, you'd have the dogs that just drop by, and hang around. Any case, that's tiger food if you're in Siberia. Really quick, what's the difference between the Amur tiger and the Siberian tiger?
It's the same thing. Oh, it's the same species. It's the same species. It's one of the same. Amur, I guess, is, I don't know. It's funny, like, who think that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what Putin calls him, but, like, I don't know if it's, like, the more correct term or whatever, because it's, like, Siberia. Maybe, is Siberian a pejorative or like a term we shouldn't use anymore? I don't know. But it also could just be too specific because it excludes, you know, China and Korea, the other, you know, areas.
Whereas the Amur River is like the bound. Is it the boundary between China and Russia?
In Russia, yeah.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We've been going for a little over an hour. Maybe wrap it up. Thanks for listening. Like we said, you can always reach out to us at urbanwildlifecast@gmail.com. We are not on social media that we used to be on for the podcast as much. So I think we sort of left X, formerly known as Twitter, behind for the most part.
Yeah. We should probably get more into it, but, you know, we always say that.
And then Facebook, I don't spend a ton of time on anymore. That email address is probably the best way to reach us. And please do like us on your podcast listening app of choice. And please consider going to the Wildlife Observer Network Patreon and chipping in a little bit to the podcast. Again, even if it's a few bucks, it those add up and help us do things like pay for the hosting and all that kind of stuff. And we appreciate it. This is a labor of love for Tony that we've been doing for a long time, man.
we had before everybody else had one.
I know. And we're glad we could keep doing it. But you know, like it's these things always have to compete with all the other demands, you know, like,
I almost feel like the popularity of podcasting has made us less interested in this. It's like now we're like, cause we do podcasts. I feel like before it was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. Now it's like, well, of course you do. Like,
who doesn't have a podcast?
You have a niche hobby, you know, or whatever. Like, it doesn't even matter. Like, everybody has like a gaming podcast or like, oh, we did this like 10 years. So,
yep.
You know, like, it's different for us.
Well, thanks for however you support it. We appreciate it. All right. Take care.
Thank you. All right. Cheers.